Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us, and this is the latest edition of the OOI's podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by a good friend, Stephen Crane, who's Visiting Research Fellow at the OIES, and we're here today to discuss his recent paper, Financing a World-Scale Hydrogen Export Project. It was published by the OIS at the beginning of January 2023. Now, just to timestamp this recording, we're recording it on the afternoon of Tuesday, the 17th of January, 2023. Stephen, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you very much, David, and I'm delighted to have been asked to join the podcast series on energy in general and hydrogen in particular.
Fantastic, Stephen. Well, look, perhaps we could start with a kind of general question. Can you perhaps kind of tell our listeners what the objectives of the paper Financing a World-Scale Hydrogen Export Project were?
Yes, certainly. I've spent most of my career advising on the financing of LNG projects, and I've been following hydrogen very closely. So I thought I would look at the title of how to finance a world-scale project, and look at the importance of the cost of capital to financing, and particularly identify what key features would be necessary in order to raise levels of project finance debt for a project. The other thing I also did was to create an archetype project, which was just a particular type of, I took a gigawatt of solar power, exporting 250,000 tons per annum of hydrogen to try to illustrate, as green ammonia, to try to illustrate how the financing might work for a project of that type.
So, Stephen, how important do you think financing is to the successful development of a hydrogen project?
I think financing is very important. If you look at LNG, for example, the majority of LNG projects have been project financed. And if you look at offshore wind, which was, I think, a strong comparison as well, over 85% of those projects by value have been project financed. And hydrogen, or green hydrogen particularly, like all renewable projects, has no material feedstock costs. So the cost of servicing debt and equity is, in this case, amounts to about 75% of the total cash cost of the project. So it is a significant level, and the cost of that financing has a real impact on the levelized cost of delivered hydrogen.
You mentioned earlier on, Stephen, that as part of your paper, you've used an archetype world-scale hydrogen export project. Perhaps could you tell our listeners, why did you choose the features that you did? And also, isn't it rather small?
Compared to some of the other projects that are being talked about these days, yes, it does perhaps start to look a bit small. I characterise some of those projects as being a bit heroic in terms of scale. I wanted to go for something that was perhaps manageable. In particular, I think that the 1 gigawatt scale sort of matches the sort of incremental bites of demand that are going to be met. I think it would be very difficult to develop a project, at least in a one-off, on the sort of scales that are being talked about, with looking to aggregate that much demand for green hydrogen at one time. That doesn't mean I don't think that those very large projects will happen. They may well do, but I think they will be expanded in incremental stages, and the financing will then be done in incremental stages. We looked at an integrated project in the sense that it would have its own solar power generation in this case, and that would then be used as a dedicated source of electricity to an electrolyzer to produce hydrogen and green ammonia. So it was integrated and an ammonia project. And the reasons for that, I think, were to limit the technical risk, particularly in terms of green ammonia. That's a pretty acceptable technology. Seems to be following a lot of other projects going in that direction these days. And I think the integration was as much as anything for simplicity.
Okay, Stephen. Now, your paper also discusses precedents or comparable energy projects to hydrogen financing. Now, LNG seems an obvious one, but what is wrong, maybe, with using LNG project financings as the base to work from?
Yes, I think LNG is clearly has a number of features in common with hydrogen, and I think a lot of developing companies have looked at it and seen, you know, you're taking a gas, maybe you're liquefying it, maybe you put it into cryogenic tankers. It all starts to look very like LNG. And technically, in many ways, it does. But I think there are some very fundamental differences at this stage for green hydrogen. And the one particular one, I think, is that LNG is fundamentally economic and green hydrogen is not. Green hydrogen will require government support in order to be economic and to be developed. I think another important point, and this actually is also a difference from renewable power, is that there isn't really any traded market for hydrogen at the moment in bulk, and there's certainly no market for green hydrogen. So volumes and prices are not only uncertain, but they're going to be created effectively by the importing countries' governments who set up the support scheme for that. So I think the issue really is that that's what makes them different. They need government support. There isn't a market. There really isn't a price. And just one other thing, which is an area for discussion that we've had, is in LNG, there is a price. It's often indexed to oil, or it may be indexed to regional gas hubs. But we've got very used in financing to having reopening clauses, so that if the price of LNG starts to become off market at any point, or typically 3 or 5 year intervals, there is an opportunity to reset the price. That really doesn't work for green hydrogen, because the whole basis of entering into the green hydrogen industry is that we expect the price to fall quite rapidly over time. So clearly, if you were to have a reopener from an early contract, it would be a one-way option to lower the price. And that would be very difficult for banks to get to grips with.
So, Stephen, from a financier's perspective, therefore, what is new or unique about green hydrogen then?
Well, I think the uniqueness is less in the technology. Clearly, if we start to go to liquid hydrogen, that will be a further step beyond LNG technologically. And that's rather why I was focusing on ammonia, because that's much more straightforward, I think. So really, the main differences, I think, is that there isn't a traded market. There is no volume other than what governments create, and there is no price other than the price that would be set under a bilateral contract. And that is very unlike renewables as well, where there is, you know, there's a deep market for electricity in regional markets, at least, not a global market. And there isn't a significant volume risk, because generally renewable power is sold with priority of dispatch. So you don't really face any significant volume risk. So I think those are the main differences.
Yeah, and of course, in that case, it's the price that needs the subsidy. Well, look, Stephen, let's kind of talk for a minute, should we, about project financing as a means of financing energy projects. What are the key and absolute requirements for project finance, therefore?
Sure. Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. Clearly, as I said at the beginning, green hydrogen is not in itself economic. It requires government support. That support can come in different ways. It can come as subsidies. It can come as sort of intermediary aggregator companies. It can come as mandates to use hydrogen for specific energy industry sectors. In any event, what the legislation is doing is socializing the cost to taxpayers or consumers one way or another. So it is, and that is absolutely fundamental to making the project work from the point of view of being able to pay for the hydrogen. So what is critical is to have robust support legislation, and that legislation, lenders can be confident, will remain in place for lenders and investors, in fact, will have to be confident it will remain in place for the life of the project. Ideally, that might be supported by a treaty backup as well. So you have a, some kind of legal recourse to the government, and this has happened in renewable energy, as we know, in the event that there has been some change in the legislation. So that would be number one. Number two is a creditworthy buyer. And this is important as well. I mean, it's interesting to note, I think, from LNG, that although LNG has been moving significantly over the years towards a traded market and a fairly deep and liquid market, there has still been no LNG financings done on the basis of pure spot trading. They've all been done on the basis of a long-term offtake. So that is still going to be critical. And the offtaker must be highly creditworthy. And that's in particular in the case of hydrogen, because, as I said earlier, the price of hydrogen, or the cost, sorry, of hydrogen is going to fall over time. That's the expectation of the learning curve. So each sort of project is expected to be selling at a lower price over time. So almost inevitably, if things work as we hope they will in the hydrogen industry, contracts that are signed early will be off market over time, and therefore there will be a reliance on government support paying a premium, and that premium will be channeled in some form through that creditworthy buyer. So those are the first two, the economic ones. I think then the third and fourth really relate to market risk. There really isn't a market, there isn't a market volume, there isn't a price at this stage, and it does rely on the government legislation. So the offtake contract will need to take those risks away from the supply project and its investors. So typically volume risk would be taken away by having some sort of fixed volume or perhaps a take or pay arrangement as for LNG. And there cannot be a market price exposure because there isn't really a market price to be exposed to. So my suggestion is a fixed price for an extended period is the most economically efficient for both parties. Indexation to, you know, an index with which lenders can be familiar. I mean, oil would be one, but seems a bit strange for an energy transition project. Electricity in the local market could be an option because that electricity could be used in the location to make green hydrogen would also be an option. But it does make the price of the hydrogen, the cost of capital, significantly higher. So in summary, I think robust government support is absolutely critical. A creditworthy buyer channeling that support into the project is critical. And then no market risk, or no material market risk, should I say, for price or volume has to be removed and absorbed by the buyer.
And one thing, Stephen, you haven't talked about, which I'm sure is important from the work you and I have been doing together over many years, is what about political risk? Because this is certainly something that is high on many governments and countries' agendas at the moment. How important is kind of political risk to project financing?
Let me take that in two parts, I suppose. If we look at LNG, which is the area that we've probably worked together on most, the focus on political risk has largely been on the supply country. You know, if you're dealing with a country that is below investment grade, shall we say, and there are concerns that there might be problems with debt and repatriation of funds and things like that. That is possible as a risk, I think, for green hydrogen as well. There are many countries that have tremendous solar or wind resource that are below investment grade. And so that could be an area of concern. And I do touch on that in the paper. But I do think that the bigger concern, particularly for export projects, which is why I think LNG has been so successful in the past, really relates to the offtake. Because if you have offshore revenue in hard currencies, most of those political risks at the producing side are much reduced. So the main areas of political risk really refer to the buying countries for the green hydrogen. Clearly, initially, I think those will be very strong countries, OECD like the European Union or Japan or South Korea. And lenders will still have concerns. I mean, there have been, you know, well-publicized problems with subsidy schemes for renewable power in Europe, for example. And I think many lenders will have less problems with some of the sort of top-ranking countries, if you like. But clearly, if the industry develops, there will be concerns about some, whether governments can afford what may look like high prices for energy in the future. And that, I think, is where having some form of energy treaty or making sure that you're dealing with a country that is a signatory to a treaty, either the EU Energy Charter, perhaps, or some bilateral trade treaties, which then will give lenders additional protection.
So, Stephen, you know, you talked earlier on about kind of price indexation. What about the price risk itself?
I think that is a challenge for green hydrogen because there really isn't a price. And that's why I sort of tend to use the comparison with offshore wind, which is economically much more similar, I think, where I think it does make sense to actually have a fixed price. There is no market at the moment. No doubt a market will develop over time for hydrogen. But as I discuss in the paper, I think the timescale for development of that market is quite long. I don't really see hydrogen getting away from requiring subsidy for 10, 15 years or more. And once it's reached the point that it doesn't require subsidy, then it still will take time for a market to develop for hydrogen, and a price and a volume traded market. So, you know, if you look at offshore wind, for example, you know, it's taken that 15 years roughly in order to get to not requiring government subsidy. And if you look at LNG, the number of years it's taken just for gas markets regionally to develop, let alone a global market. So I can see regional markets in the US and the European Union being developed by sort of force of law almost. But a sort of natural global traded market in hydrogen, I wouldn't see that happening for significantly more than two decades. And that's beyond the life of contracts that we would be looking at signing in the next 5 to 10 years.
Now, Stephen, we discussed the Archetype project earlier. You know, perhaps now a bit of a challenging question. You know, how much debt could such a project raise, do you think?
I think it can raise a lot of debt, but it really depends on, initially, the project has to be bankable. It has to meet the criteria we were discussing earlier on. And then the level of debt will depend on probably two things in particular. One will be price. You know, what sort of, is the price indexed? You know, if, unfortunately, the price were indexed to ammonia, which would initially seem appealing, but it's a very volatile price, and it's not a very deeply traded market. You know, lenders would look at that, and you know, from a typical ammonia project, you would see a debt equity ratio probably not much more than 50 or 60%. And given it was new green hydrogen, it would be less than that. And that really doesn't help the economics along very well. If it's a fixed price, more like one would see with offshore wind. And when I say fixed, I mean that might be affected by a contract for differences, but you have to ask what is a different to. Then I think the level of debt could increase significantly. There is one feature in the paper which I've not touched on just yet, and that's completion risk. LNG projects generally have, all projects have completion risk, of course. LNG projects have generally had the sponsors provide guarantees of completion because I think they felt it just wasn't a good economic balance to persuade lenders, at least, to take a completion risk. I think in the case of green hydrogen and looking at offshore wind, completion risk has been taken by lenders earlier and more frequently than it has for LNG. Now, there are pros and cons about that, But I think one of the cons of lenders taking that sort of level of completion risk means that they will lend less. They want to keep a degree of dry powder, if you like, in terms of funding. So what I said in the paper, I would expect that the initial levels of debt funding would be in the region of 65%, possibly more with completion guarantees. But as lenders become more familiar and assuming that the completion risk is, the track record is good, I would see that rising up to about 80%, which is where offshore wind is now, and perhaps some of the more aggressive LNG projects, particularly tolling, would be at.
And Stephen, do you think that the debt markets have adequate capacity?
Absolutely. That's the easiest question. I think there are probably four sources of debt, four or five that I speak about. There's concessionary finance, which is to support imports generally from the importing countries. There's export credit agency finance, which would be supporting the export of the equipment required. And there's the commercial bank and bond markets. Any of the last three could fund entirely on their own the Archetype project. So I see no difficulty there. I'd also mention that LNG projects have raised up to, I think recently, $17 billion of debt. So I really don't see market capacity as a problem, as long as the project meets the bankability criteria.
Stephen, let's finish off by discussing the competitiveness of debt, because the cost of financing is obviously key as developers seek to develop competitive projects. So I suppose my question is, how can the cost of capital be minimised?
Yes, David, that is a very important point. And working in renewable energy, particularly finance, one sees the importance of minimising the cost of capital. And there's a couple of steps to doing that, really. The first one is to maximise the level of debt that you can raise for the project initially. Debt is much cheaper than equity, and it's usually tax deductible, which makes it cheaper still. So having the maximum level of debt is important. Maintaining as high a level of debt over the life of the project is also very important. And I'd say that can be done in two ways. I mean, the ideal is you're trying basically to postpone the point at which you have to repay your debt. And you can do that either by borrowing long tenor debt, maybe with export credits or using bonds. But also, if you're in a market where financing or refinancing risk is not critical, it may well be that refinancing is the way to go. I mean, for example, I said if you can initially raise only 65% of debt, and as the market sort of becomes more familiar with green hydrogen, it goes up to 80, then it might be that you could raise more debt than you did at the beginning of the project. And so that would be a very efficient way to improve the cost of capital. Two other things, it's clearly minimizing the cost of debt, you know, the price you actually pay to the bank. Is critical and important, and that can be done by maximising concessionary funds and maximising the degree of competition when you do raise the money. But interestingly, that is certainly secondary to actually having the most debt over time. And then lastly, a point I touch on, which is not something you see so much in the LNG industry, but is certainly very common in the renewable industry, is where the developers sell down a portion of their equity over time. So the developer is taking significant risk in terms of developing the project, taking the completion risk probably. If they can then get the project to the point where it's significantly de-risked, it's on stream, they can sell their equity to an infrastructure fund. And in doing that, they release capital, they make a small profit in that process, and they have further capital to invest in future projects as well.
Stephen, thank you so much for your time today and your insights from your recent paper, Financing a World-Scale Hydrogen Export Project, was published by the OAS at the beginning of January 2023. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.